Hello and welcome to episode 100 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast from Golf Australia magazine exploring the whys and wherefores of the appeal to so many of this insane game. My name's Rod Murray, and this is an episode with a bit of a difference. Normally, our guests are golfers first and foremost, but sometimes it's those who are golf adjacent who have the most interesting perspective to offer. That's the case on episode 100, where I sat down with Bryony Lyle, wife of former PGA Tour player and one of Australia's most popular golfers, Jared. As most golfers know, Jared passed in 2018 at the tragically young age of 36, leaving behind Bryony and daughters Lucy and Gemma. Jared's life in golf has been well documented, and while we touch on some of the sadness of his final days, the bulk of this interview is an insight into how professional golf looks to a non-golfing partner. Bryony is a strong, open, and honest character, and this discussion goes off in all sorts of unexpected directions. It's a memory of Jared, yes, but it's also an acknowledgement of Bryony and the road she's travelled in both golf and life. Now, a word of warning, this is a long interview, but remember, one of the joys of podcasting means that you don't have to listen to it all in one go. I do urge you to stay with it, though, as it's equal parts powerful, moving, and educational about how this game seeps into every part of people's lives. Well, the first thing we have to say is a big thank you, Bryony, as I do to all my guests. It's not a small commitment to do The Thing About Golf, so we appreciate you taking some time. The clue's in the title, The Thing About Golf. You're one of our rare non-golfers that we've had, though, of course, you have a strong connection with golf. Jared, your husband, I can't imagine there's anybody who doesn't know, but we lost Jared 5 years ago, almost to the day. In fact, we're recording this not long after the fifth anniversary of his passing. Let's start with that. What's the thing about golf for Bryony Lyle?
That's a fascinating question, because these past few years especially, I find myself explaining to people how I've ended up in the golf industry. And as someone who has been, you know, I'm in meetings with the PGA and I'm in meetings with Golf Australia and I'm at their events and I'm, you know, guest speaking at a couple of small little fundraising events that we've had. And I just find it so bizarre. And Jared would be laughing at me to think that, you know, I'm in this space when the game of golf itself has got to be one of the most frustrating sports ever to have been invented. I don't understand how magnetic it is, how people just, they get addicted to this game, and yet it's so frustrating. And I just have never gotten into it. My answer's always going to be really long.
Good. Excellent. These are a long podcast, so you've got room to explore.
Okay, great. I think the thing is that because I got into it at the highest level, that was my introduction to it, probably did a bit of disservice to my, not necessarily knowledge of it, but appreciation for the game maybe, because it was a job from the minute, you know, I knew about it, really. Mm. Not my job, obviously, but quickly, you know, quickly took over my life as well. And to the point where, I mean, it took months and months for me to feel like I could speak the lingo mm-hmm. around people that knew the game. And otherwise I would just be silent at golf events and walking the course with Jared, because I just didn't know what people were talking about. I also very quickly learnt that you can talk the talk of golf and it doesn't mean you're a good golfer.
There'd be about 100 people in the world allowed to talk about it if that was the rules, Bryony. None of us would be allowed to play. As you well know, they're rare, really good players. Have you ever been tempted? You must have at some point picked up a golf club, I assume. And what was your own response to it? Not everybody takes to golf. Lots of people try and go, don't get it. Are you one of those?
Yes. No, well, I grew up playing hockey, field hockey.
That's a head start.
Well, yes, I can hit it. All I enjoy doing is standing on the range with my driver and hitting that. That's the only thing in the game that I enjoy. And I'll never forget the first time I stood up there. And I've only ever used Jared's clubs. Like if he was at the range or something, I'd kind of, I'll have a hit if you like.
Sure, why not? They can't be that much different, can they, to the other clubs?
No, that's what I thought too. Can't everybody just pick up anybody's clubs? I don't understand that either. And he just, like my first shot, he just fell over and wet himself laughing at me. He just said, there's so much wrong and I don't even know where to start. So he knew he wasn't a coach. No. It was like he couldn't help other people. He knew what worked for him because he was so much of a feel player. Mm. But he knew that he couldn't help me. He just found it immensely entertaining.
Indeed. Speaking of Jared, I imagine you must have come to recognise the beauty that was his golf swing, the fluid motion.
You know, I like it that you say I would have noticed how smooth it was. It looks like everyone else's golf
swing. Oh, Bryony.
I would have filmed it, you know, like a thousand times standing behind him on the range, you know, like, can you just film me doing, you know, like, and oh, can you tell me the difference between this swing and the next? No, I can't. I'm out. And I did end up getting a set of golf clubs at some stage, and it's not even a full set because I said to him, don't get me all the silver ones because I don't know what they do and I can't even hit them.
So did you just say the silver ones?
I said
oh, my goodness. I understand why you were careful about speaking at golf tournaments.
Yes, I know. I'll never forget the first time someone said to me at an event, I think it was playing down at Moona Links, and someone said, oh, wasn't that a great up and down? Where? And down where? I'm like, what are you talking about?
Then you go to America, they call it an up and in. It's like, what are you talking about? This is madness.
Yeah. No, I don't. So I do have a set of clubs.
But not the silver ones.
I knew just not all the silver ones. I've only got a few of those.
That's magnificent, Brian. I think you've got a very healthy relationship with the game that many of us should probably take some notes about. You and Jared go way back. Way back.
We did go to high school together. And yes, I had known him back then, but we certainly didn't start dating then. We didn't move in the same circles. He was just, as far as I was concerned, he was almost like, because we grew up in Shepparton. So as a young kid in Shepparton, to get your photo in the paper, that was like the pinnacle of, you know, sporting prowess. So, and his photo was in the paper all the time. So I just remember that's who he was at school to me. He was, oh, who's that? He's like the most famous kid I know. but not in kind of like an, you know, like it wasn't overwhelmed. I still didn't understand really what he did.
So what happened? When did you meet? When did you sort of start to date? And
well, it wasn't until, I know I should know these dates. I think it was maybe, we finished in 99, I think it was maybe 2007 where we kind of touched base again. I was a catch at that point in time,
right.
Working in a petrol station, living in a caravan park. I was just burnt out after uni, actually. Just couldn't imagine, like, I just didn't want to go straight into, you know, career, whatever that was going to be. I don't even ask me what that was going to be. And I just, you know, obviously needed to keep working and whatever. And I was in between, I was actually doing some fruit picking and in Shepparton and then working in the petrol station as well in Melbourne. So a couple of things going on. And I think it might have been a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning. He'd missed the cut. No, so back up a little, I reckon during the week I had been unpacking newspapers, the Herald Sun. It was unpacking the Herald Sun at the petrol station to put it out, you know, for people to purchase. And there was his photo front and center on the front, either the front or the back of the newspaper, a big photo of him, because he was involved with Challenge, and he'd done a photo shoot that week with a young Challenge boy called Ted, who was a really young boy and got along really well. And they'd done a big photo shoot of him. And I remember unpacking this newspaper thinking, I went to school with this guy. I also went to uni and here I am working, you know, like I'm in a petrol station, you know, and here he is gone on to these amazing things and doing this amazing work with Challenge and, you know, how amazing. And literally a few days later, he walked into the petrol station
to get petrol.
Yeah. Yes. Well, no, to get Diet Coke because he'd missed the cut at whatever it was. It would have been, I think it was the Masters or something. See, again, he would know these things. and had had a big night. So he was seedy and he was driving into the city to pick someone up or do something. Uh-huh. And he was addicted to Diet Coke. Uh-huh. And at the last second pulled in to get one. I happened to walk in and I just thought, this is, I've literally just seen you on the new, you know.
Did he recognize you from school?
Yeah, we did. We did both. And I had a name tag on as well. So that's that probably, you know, yeah, made it a bit easier. But we just had a kind of a quick chat. He was clearly, you know, it was, I had, there were other customers, you know, it was just kind of a quick, how are you going, you know. And I think we'd both kind of said we'll both be in Shepparton over Christmas and, oh, you know, maybe we'll, you know, maybe we'll, I'll see you there or whatever, not knowing that, you know, his time in Shepparton is spent doing a lot of golf-related things and whatever he does.
Being Jared.
Exactly. So I went home that day and, well, I must have mentioned something to my dad. He's one of these people growing up. He grew up outside of Shepparton, but one of those people who, you know, he'll make a connection between anyone in the greater Goulburn Valley area. Oh, isn't that the cousin of the someone that owned the store in, well, you know, like he just, and he's got to know surnames and you know, wants to know everything about everyone to try and figure out where do they fit in the community. And I happened to say to him, oh, you'll never guess who I saw today. And then I realised I didn't have any, like we didn't exchange contact details or anything, even though we'd said, you know, maybe we could catch up in Shepparton. So I stalked him a little bit and I found him on Facebook and I sent him a message, like a direct message and said, you know, I'm not going to friend you. I'm not going to send you a friend request because I don't think we can call ourselves friends. And I'm also not going to ask you to share any information via social media because you might not be comfortable, but here's my number. And, you know, if you do end up in Shepparton and have any free time, you know, maybe we can catch up.
It's a long way of saying you hit on him, basically, isn't it?
I mean, I guess so. But it was also, at that point in time, it was no more than, oh, it'd be great to hear what he's been up to. Like, he, you know, I'm working in a petrol station.
You're interesting.
He's clearly, you know, like he's travelled the world. Yeah. You know, I'd love to hear about that. I'd love to actually find out what's it been like.
And at that time, he'd already been through his first bout of acute myeloid leukaemia. Am I pronounced that rightly?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So, and the last time I had actually seen him in person had been, because I remember, again, we weren't friends, and I like to make sure that, you know, if his close friends do listen to this, that they can appreciate that I distanced myself at that time because I wasn't in his circle. But I do remember the flurry of activity that went on when he was diagnosed at school, and I remember seeing his mum meeting with, you know, the teacher or the principal or something going on, you know. So we were very aware of what was happening, not that any of us really understood it. Yeah. And it was far more distressing and whatever for his close mates to try and figure that out. But for me, I didn't, other than, okay, he's someone that I go to school with. We had a couple of classes together. You know, he's now unwell, but zero concept of what that meant and what his life then became at that point in time. And it's only because I then got to know him and then, you know, hear what that was all about and to compare that to what I was doing at the time, it just kind of blew my mind that we had no concept of how drastic
things. You feel inadequate, don't you, when you hear somebody's story who's been through what you, because I'm not sure whether people realise. I interviewed Jared once and he spoke about that. It clearly shaped him in many ways. I think, sounds silly, in some ways for the better. I think he became the person he was because he'd seen a dark side, didn't want to be part of that dark side as a young man. Yeah. He was such a big character, wasn't he? He filled a room.
Yeah, he could without meaning to. And I think, and he would agree with it, you know, like, being from Shepparton as well, like to see the way those guys up there and his close mates at the Shep Golf Club, they would bring him back down to earth the minute he walked through the door. It was just, and I love that about it, that There was no, we don't give a shit who you are or what event you've just played or, you know, what your prize money was.
It's almost a worship from an equal level. I mean, they would have worshipped him in his golf game, done anything for him, but we're all on the same level here because we're at Shep. I can imagine that. And they probably, you would know, would they have been some of his happier times on the golf course in some ways?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. He's the memories of the things that happened at Shep are so vivid to him as well, you know, names and dates and, you know, really just phenomenal memory for things like that. And you know, which club he hit on which hole and on which round. We're like, oh, that's ridiculous.
Can almost hear him turning over now, Bryony, listening to you talking about the silver ones and some club he hit on some hole. Golf is very different for the wives of PGA Tour players than it is for the players themselves. Golf, in fact, is an all-consuming. It consumes everything around the player. Everything is about that player being able to perform at their best. What was that life like for you? It's a long way from a petrol station and caravan in Melbourne to the PGA Tour. In fact, those two worlds almost don't inhabit the same planet, do they?
Yeah, correct. It was it was an eye-opener. It was a couple of years in, like we kind of did long distance for a good couple of years first, and I was working in Shepparton for a couple of years before that we kind of made the decision that, all right, there's something here, and in order for us to actually explore that, one of us needs to
move to the other.
Yes. And without having to ask the question.
You decided to give up your petrol station, jump my money.
At that point I was at Tate. I was actually, you know, something slightly above. I knew that's what it needed to be, that in order for us to kind of see where things were at, I needed to go to him. His work was in the US. That wasn't going to change anytime soon. So, I had to resign, give up everything kind of and spend all the money I had to get myself a ticket to go to the US, which was terrifying.
Was it an easy decision?
It was easy in that I was looking forward to spending time with him. We used to joke even after 2 years that we were kind of still dating on the internet because we, you know, Skyping and emailing and was how we got to, you know, got to know each other, really. I saw him in person so rarely in those couple of years. And subsequently I realised he actually flew home far more times than he normally would. But even then it was, you know, a couple of days here and there, months apart.
Yeah, indeed. Moving to the US, exciting, daunting. You said the word terrifying there. I would imagine there are a bunch of mixed feelings. You're not going there by yourself. There's a safety net at the other end. It's Jared. He's got a career. Things are going okay. You would have been playing, I imagine. Is he playing the secondary tour or the PGA Tour by then?
I think it was PGA.
Because they're two different worlds again.
Yes.
Related but very different worlds, the secondary tour.
Yeah. I know. At that time, Nationwide, it's still in my head, it's Nationwide Tour. I think it was Nationwide when I first headed over.
So that lifestyle, I imagine a lot of driving between tournaments and compared to the PGA Tour where there's an assigned chef when you get there and there's courtesy cars for this
there's
and lockers
cars,
for that. Assuming you arrived in the Nationwide days, did you at any point think to yourself, was this a good idea? We just seem to be driving around America to second-rate golf courses.
Yes, and they're further from, like, the PGA Tour ones, you know, the location of them is, you know, major cities and there's lots of accommodation and, you know, everything's there, whereas the Nationwide ones are in the backwaters. Some of the places you went to were, you know, like you wouldn't even know they existed.
Rich Beam won his first golf tournament in a town called Truth or Consequences in New Mexico.
Stop it.
Truth or Consequences in New Mexico.
I know Rich Beam. I've been to his house.
I'm not surprised you know Rich Beam. I would imagine that he and Jared would have immediately formed a bond, both with great senses of humour and larger-than-life characters.
Yes.
That's a hell of a way to get to know somebody intimately that you'll go on to marry. to live on the road doing sort of golf. Was it romantic? Would you write a book about it, or was it like harder than it might look from the outside?
It was so hard. I had, you know, like a lot of people before I left had said, oh, it's so going to be so glamorous. You know, you're going to be traveling. It's going to be amazing. It was a hard slog from the minute, you know, I got off the plane, basically, because to realize that for me, he's playing a sport. Mm. You know, like it's not.
Not even a proper sport. There's no sweating. There's no running. Nobody's running. What are we doing here?
Exactly. But to realize that, you know, he was heading to work each day and we're like hotel rooms. What am I supposed to do? I don't know these places. I haven't got a car. I can't drive anywhere. I can't do anything. I can't go anywhere. If I go to the course with him, I'm literally just sitting in the clubhouse or standing behind him on the range for 5 or 6 hours. And most of that time watching him talk about AFL with the other Aussie players and caddies on the range and tell me how hard he's been working. And they're just kind of standing around talking shit with each other.
So what do you do?
Well, I'm also someone that can't do – I need a purpose. I had him organized very quickly within an inch of his life. You know, I had our itinerary planned.
You're a travel agent, all of those things. You're the bookkeeper, the accountant.
I kind of became his business manager, which is what he had to employ me in order for me to get a visa to go to the US. We had to go the process of applying for a visa where he would employ me as a business manager.
Right.
And that's how a lot of partners, unmarried partners of the Aussie players or the, you know, international players, that's what they had to do. But I took it seriously. I will manage your business because that you need someone to do that. And his dad had been doing it from Australia up until that point in time.
It's an interesting dynamic, Bryony, for a romantic relationship. There's got to be some separation. I know that Sarah Jane Smith and her husband, Dwayne, there's a caddy player relationship there. Rebecca Flood also had her husband caddy for her. And you would feel this, I too. There's got to be a line between work and home. Yeah. It would be very difficult to maintain, I would think, sometimes.
Really, really difficult. But what I think worked for us was the fact that I did not give a shit about what had happened on the course that day. Uh-huh. And I was... We did not need to dissect every shot on every, and he learned that very quickly. Like, you know, coming home one day and saying, "What did you think about that? The third shot that I hit into the fourth. What are you talking about?
Where's the check?
How on earth do you think I can remember that? Like the fact that I walked 18 holes and looked like I was paying attention and knew what you were doing for 5 hours. Like, pat me on the back, but let's not." Let's not talk about this again. I'm done with it.
If all our golf talk has you itching for a round, check out the Golf Now app. Easily book social golf online at hundreds of courses across Australia, including some of Golf Australia's top 100 tracks. Download the free app or visit golfnow.com.au today. It's quite an education, I'd imagine, too. It's an unusual job and profession, and you've had a very unique insight into that on two levels, personal and sort of the professional. What opinions did you form about professional golf as an industry?
I don't know, because all I knew about it was bloody hard work, and it felt a bit like a travelling circus. The fact that we were all at this event – nationwide at this point in time, all of these guys, you know, amicable on the range, having a great banter, you know, back and forth in the clubhouse, getting to know people. And I'm, you know, there were a lot of Aussie players there at that stage, a lot of Aussie caddies, and getting to know them and kind of feeling like we're forming friendships and whatever. But I don't think Jared was unusual in this. He didn't then want to socialize with them. Like we wouldn't, sometimes we'd go out for dinner with a couple of them, but you weren't making dinner plans to catch up with everyone off the course when the tournament had started. So everyone was there in the same little town, probably going to the same restaurants. You see like five tables around you of golfers, but you don't, you know, and you're pleasant. But when the competition, you know, when the event starts, they're in Yeah. That's their competition.
They want to step on each other's throats, almost literally.
Yes.
You have to have that if you're going to win at that level too. It's hard scrabble. There's no...
Exactly. Exactly. And then half of them aren't even going to make any money that week because they, you know, they missed the cut. And yet they all then get on the planes and go, like this whole circus packs up here and moves to the, you know, it's the same faces. It's the same support staff. It's the same... And yet you're not doing it together. You're doing it very much... separately.
You float just above it in a way, don't you? Everybody just floats a little bit above it. Nobody's grounded in it. It's going, because, of course, the other thing that happens is every year a whole bunch of them disappear.
Yes.
Lose their car.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. You're gone.
And we – and I think in – I mean, I think for Jared, having me there meant he had someone to do all of this with because otherwise he's on his own. Mm. Like, you know, he has a good relationship with the caddies or, whoever's on his bag at the time. That's fine, but it's still – there's that professional nature. And if someone else comes along and offers that caddy more money, he's gone.
Yep.
He's, you know, he's going to follow that. So they just, it's a weird thing.
It's a surreal lifestyle in many ways. Even when, and that, there's more money about it when you get to the PGA Tour and the rewards are greater, but the attitude doesn't really change, does it? That doesn't change. In fact, it's perhaps guarded more jealously in some ways.
I think so. And we did, and the reality is too, you can take a step up to the PGA Tour. It's going to cost you more to actually get from to turn up and do your job. And so Jared and I, like, very concerned. We weren't staying in the worst of the worst hotels, which the caddies would have been, several to a room to try and save as much money as they possibly could and eating, you know, the cheapest that they could find. We wouldn't stay in the worst of the worst. We'd try and stay in places that had little kitchens for us so we could try and cook for ourselves because you're eating out 3 days a week. Three times a day, 7 days a week, which gets old, you know, very quickly.
It's not the joyous lifestyle we think of from the outside. And even if you're doing well and making all the money, it doesn't have the joy about it that you would imagine from the outside because we don't see all of that that goes on in the background.
No, no. It's just hard. And the mental side of it too for the players. I think Jared was able to switch off because I would make him. So I just wasn't interested in dissecting his game and nor could I offer anything to him, you know, to help in any way. And so I think I honestly think we saw some of his best golf at that point in time because otherwise he had been on his own or with his brother when his brother had caddied. So not only were they together all day, they were sharing a room together and they were eating together and they were, you know, so it was just, it was 24/7.
In your head.
Yeah. Yeah.
For all of that, Briony, I imagine it was a wonderful time and I imagine you created all sorts of memories between you and Jared and they would have been great times. But, of course, in 2012 or 2013, that shock of a second diagnosis, which was an Jared was unwell for a while, but I don't imagine you would have guessed that that might have been the ultimate diagnosis. Talk a bit about that time and I imagine that would have been really difficult.
Yes, because we had just been married in the December. So we knew that was kind of the end of me being over there for 2 years and we came home in about October when they, like there's a slight break on the PGA Tour and you kind of decided we're going home to play the Aussie events. Yep. And so we headed home in about October knowing we were planning a wedding and I was also pregnant. But the wedding was going to be like a really small affair and then we were going to have a party with a lot of people and, but we weren't telling them that we were getting married because we just weren't prepared to have something really big. And then he must have played a couple of the Aussie events and then headed back for Q school and got through Q school and then said it in an interview when he was interviewed at the end of Q school. Can't wait to go home and get married. And suddenly I was getting messages from people, hang on a minute. Like, and it was literally, I think it was like we were getting married on the Saturday and this would have been like the Monday or the Tuesday of that week. Uh-huh. You know, he was being interviewed in the US. Oh, you got your tour? Oh, yeah, can't wait to go home and get married. So everyone that we'd invited to celebrate this party, because we'd both turned 30, we'd gotten engaged during the year, we were pregnant, so we were kind of rolling five things into one and just having a celebration with people that we didn't get to see. So I'm getting all these messages saying, a week up to a wedding? Are you actually getting, oh, like the worst kept secret ever that he broke it. So that was in the December. And he came home super, super jet lagged, you know, like whether, I don't know what his memories are of the actual wedding itself, but he was so really jet lagged and tired. And then that was a Saturday. And the Sunday we drove to Melbourne because it was then going to be the Aussie Masters or whatever it was that week. So we were, you know, that was our honeymoon was, and then had a couple of weeks off and then he was off to Hawaii, you know, first week of January. So, yeah, married early December, golf, Christmas, New Year, and gone again. And I stayed back because I was 6 months pregnant and due to give birth in the March. So, yeah, he headed off, played pretty well. That was when he had his top four, tied fourth at Riviera. Things were kind of all heading in the right direction. And just like, of course, in hindsight, you look back and kind of go, yeah, okay, so that probably could have told us if we knew what we know now, you know, like that could have been the sign that something wasn't right with his body. And then, oh, maybe that could have been the sign, you know. So, like I say, he was jet lagged.
Was it a constant sort of concern? Like, did you ever think about, like, any time Jared got sick, did you just think, well, hang on a minute, that might be? Or had it sort of, it was the past and you never gave it a thought? Right, okay, yeah.
Well, I know for myself, I mean, I'm sure things, you know, were kind of would go around in his head, but no, it wasn't even a thing.
Right.
It wasn't even on my radar at all as being anything to be concerned about. So, you know, I've even just said he was jet lagged.
Yeah.
But right. Like fatigue and exhaustion is, you know, one of the signs that, you know, there's something wrong with your body. So, but we could have put it, you know, jet lagged and then golf and then Christmas and then you, and then, you know, you always put it down to something else.
Even a doctor would look at that schedule and say, yeah, it's probably not surprising you're a bit tired, Jared.
Yeah. It's fairly exactly. Hectic. Exactly. So, and he was coming home. We'd booked him to come home for the birth of our child. Like it was, you know, no other reason than that. Like we looked at the schedule, we looked at the dates, and we obviously knew when I was due, you know, when will we fly you home, how many weeks will you miss, which I think was, he was only going to be there for about 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. So we had to, like, it was all scheduled. It was all, like with everything in his life, it was all timing and whatever, and figuring out the best option, you know, like, do you go and play those early events because they can be weaker fields? A lot of the guys, the big names, don't necessarily play the like the West Coast events to start the year. So great, go, because you know it moves you up the list of in terms of, you know, the strength of the field and all this stuff you have to take into account.
Sorry, so which is professional golf? Professional golf actually has nothing to do with how you're hitting it and putting and all of those sort of things. Professional golf is the things you're talking about. How do I move up the money list? How do I guarantee I've got a card for next year and then a job for next year?
Yes. Yeah. No, but you're right. And then, like, that only exacerbated, I'm sure we'll get to it, but exacerbated when you've got 20 medical starts on your medical or whatever. Okay, this is math now. This is the logistics of where have you played well? What's the climate like?
Yeah.
You know, like what sort of grass do they, you know, like what do you play better on?
Yep.
Which ones are we going to pick?
Yep.
And then the logistics of getting there,
yep.
You know, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, so we very much, and of course we didn't plan because we weren't planning on getting pregnant, but we didn't plan when I was due, but there is this discussion around what's the best window to get you home, and to which ones are you going to miss, and therefore what should you play in it beforehand, what, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So he came home just as, you know, by the by, this is what's happening. I was 2 weeks out from my due date, and it was a Tuesday, arrived home Tuesday morning. From the airport, I didn't go down and pick him up. His sister and her partner picked him up because I wasn't sure about getting in the car and driving that far. So dropped him home. He'd had this, what he thought was a bite on his arm,
yeah.
And had it looked at over there and drained. I think in Mexico.
In
had
Mexico.
Drained or
feels,
something.
Feels like it was in Mexico, yeah.
Yeah. But, again, like just thought nothing of it. You know, just, oh, that would be annoying. And because it's a, you know, like you're moving it, yeah. And you, it's part of your swing. I could just, all these other reasons as to why it got as bad as it did, I guess. But they'd given him some kind of antibiotics that we realized he was allergic to. So when he got home, he was kind of head to toe covered in a rash. And so I'd made an appointment. I knew that, and I'd made an appointment just to go and see his GP in Shepparton, just to get that checked out and, you know, figure out, do we need to do something about that, or will it just kind of disappear? And his GP had been the one who had diagnosed him initially, and had said, let's get some bloods done and just be really thorough with this. And again, it could have been dismissed. It could have been, yes, allergic reaction. Don't, you know, you're allergic to sulfur drugs.
Switch to these and you'll be fine.
Yes. Yeah. But, again, to his credit, like, his GP was just so thorough and said, let's get results done. And so, so went and had bloods, went back home. I'm 38 weeks pregnant. Yeah. Oh, like, it was hot, you know.
You're not in the mood, I'm telling you.
No, I'm just like dancing around. Yeah. I'm like, this is the rest of the day. And he's tired or whatever. And a good friend of ours had literally the day before had dropped off a CD with all of our wedding photos, because he'd taken photos at our wedding, and he literally just dropped it off the day before. And so I said to Jared, hey, let's sit down and watch this. So we put that on, and a good mate of his rang his phone, and then the two of them, it's funny how quickly, I mean, I'm there for how quickly the potty mouth comes out when some of his mates get on the phone with him. And he missed a couple of calls, like from an unknown number, which we now know is a GP trying to call him. And then they rang me, and I answered, and they said, we really need to speak to Jared. And here he is, like, swearing his head off, talking to his mate on the phone. And I had to say, okay, can you just hang that up? He's like, just wait, you know, I'll be finished in a minute. No urgency, no nothing. I said, oh, no, you need to take this call. And it was the call to say, get yourself, like, we've booked you into St. Vincent's. You need to get, you know, like, you've relapsed. You need to get to Melbourne now. After just literally arriving in the country hours before. Yeah.
Lots of people every day all over the world have this happen to them. Just this phone call that puts a marker in time. There's life before and then there's life after.
Yeah.
With everything going on, what's that moment like for you and Jared?
So different for both of us, because it meant something to him that it didn't mean to me. Mm-hmm. Because it just immediately, for him, it was, he knew what it meant. And I pretty much watched this guy who I had just married fold in on himself and become a little boy again. And all he wanted was his parents. So he kind of rang them straight away. They didn't live far away. We got in the car and drove to their house, and they pretty much, it was like physically folded around him, and I was on the outside. Because I didn't understand. They very much made it clear to me, you don't know anything about this. He needs us right now. We know what we're doing. So leave it to us. Don't bother yourself with this.
Yeah.
Even though he was my husband and I was literally about to give birth to our child, and had, you know, like pregnancy brain and all the rest of it happening as well. And I needed, I just need information. That's how I always operate. I'm the person who, you know, like when they would introduce a new drug or something and give us this massive handout of, I'd read it.
Right. Okay, you're the person. You know, you're the only one.
The one person. But I, you know, like information is power, and you know, that's, I needed it because I they were right. I had zero experience with any of this, and it almost feels like to this day I could hardly tell you what acute myeloid leukemia is, because nobody sat me down with Jared to give me the introduction to this is what this is all about. They just went into it as if, like, we know what we're doing. We've been here before. They'd, no, don't, you don't need to tell us.
Yeah.
Just, you know, let's get moving.
That's incredibly complex on so many levels, Bryony, you know, that the one thing you need in that situation is the one thing you can't have, which is time to process.
Yes.
Emotions are running incredibly high. And
yeah.
That's a difficult way to start a married life. whether it could it could tear people apart. You could see how that happened. That didn't happen for you and Jared, though.
No, it didn't. That first, like those days immediately following that, I mean, they're so vivid in my mind about everything that happened because, again, with what was happening with me being pregnant, I couldn't get in the car with him and drive him to Melbourne at that point in time. I had an appointment the next morning with my obstetrician that was as important, not as, well.
Kind of, absolutely.
Yes, you know, like it, the so he headed off with his mum and dad and sister and, who you know, off they went to go and do something that I really had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I stayed in Shepparton on my own, stayed back in Shepparton. And I think the following, you know, and I remember having to kind of say to people on the phone because they were hearing it through other people and having to say, yes, and like he's relapsed. I don't really know. And I remember having to ring his good friend Shannon Wallace, who's a caddy in the US and has been for a long time. And he had just come on board and had just done those few events, kind of Hawaii and the few weeks afterwards, early in that year, and had to ring him and say, "You need to find another bag. Like he's relapsed. I don't know what it means. I don't know. I don't know if he's going to be back in a couple of months. I'm sorry." And
getting that news is awful. You've then had to give that news to others, which I suppose in an odd way is equally awful.
Yeah. When I really hadn't, I couldn't tell anyone. I couldn't explain here to them what was going on.
Here's the four words I know about this. Don't ask any questions. I don't have any more.
Yeah.
I imagine you and Jared.
So I then had to follow him.
Yeah.
It was the next day I went to my obstetrician, explained what was going on, and she agreed that I could be induced. That was the Wednesday morning. I could be induced on the Friday, which was a week early. She was happy for that to happen because I had said maybe he could be there if it could happen really quickly. So we agreed that that was a potential. And so I got in the car that afternoon and drove down to Melbourne to the hospital, and it's almost like they were literally about to start hanging the chemo and get him started. And I had to just say, look, just stop. Like, stop for a minute. I'm his wife. Someone needs to talk to me about what's going on right now. We need to have discussions. We need to make decisions. I'm about to have a baby. I was under a lot of pressure to actually move myself to give birth in Melbourne so that he could be closer but still in a different hospital, you know, and still once chemo started, there was no chance he could leave to be at the birth. So I had to kind of fight a room full of people and medical professionals and say, how can we make this happen so he can be at the birth of this child? Like, what do we need to put in place for this to happen? And I discharged him against medical advice to go back to Shepparton and be there at the birth, and then he was gone within 12 hours to head back and get started on treatment.
I imagine his head spinning through this whole thing too, this extraordinarily horrendous thing is happening to him, and the worst of it is this time he knows what's coming. He's been through it before, so he knows what's coming. And no matter who you are, that's frightening. Equally important, and you were hesitant to use the term as important, you're about to have a baby, but equally important to him and you, but to him as well, is this whole other life that's about to happen. My head's spinning, Brandy. My head is spinning thinking about it, and that is not a patch on what it must have been like to be in it.
To be, yes, and to have these two massive life events going on that I actually knew nothing about either of them. Like, to be so torn in that. But the one thing I knew was that, like, it's from Jared's point of view, it's one thing to think you know what seeing a child being born will do for you, know, like that connection, you know, like ask any parent, you know, for the first time, just that. It's one thing to think you know, but I knew for a fact he needed to be there. He needed to experience that, because if we took that away from him, like he would be fighting for what he thought he knew, but not what he actually experienced.
That's really, it's maybe the deepest thing that's ever been said on this podcast, Bryony. And it's an extraordinary thing. The parallel I would think with golf, and I don't know whether you ever got to say this to Jared, but you can't know, and I will never know, you will never know, most professional golfers will never know what it's like to win a golf tournament. You can only learn it by doing it. There's no other, you can practice it, you can visualize it, you can do drills, you can do whatever you want, and none of it will feel anything like when it happens. And that's kind of what you're describing.
Yeah, yeah. And so I knew that he needed that, all the emotions and everything that went with that experience to drive him, because from what, like the little bits and pieces I was kind of picking up, was very clear that if his chemo had started and he was hospitalized, he wouldn't have been allowed out for a certain amount of time. Equally, I possibly wouldn't have been allowed in to see him either with a newborn.
That was an issue, was it not? Was there not? He had to see Lucy at a certain time because he was about to start radiation, I think, was it not?
Yeah, there were different things along the way that we had to learn, because so he was there for the birth. 12 hours later, he was gone. He then didn't see her for 4 weeks.
Yeah, that's right.
In person, because I couldn't drive. I had a cesarean, couldn't get myself there. They kept me in hospital and her in hospital for a week. So we're in hospital in Shepparton while he's in hospital, you know, experiencing things that he could never, you know, have no clue what we were doing. I had no clue what he was doing, was in no state of mind to actually really get my head around any of it. It was just pure survival mode. So we didn't actually get down to see him in person again for probably 4 weeks. And yet here I am with a child learning what motherhood is all about. Yeah, it was just the most bizarre. Even when I think back on it, it's all the emotions come up again. It's really just like panic, and not emotions that you would necessarily equate to first time, you know, like literally those first few weeks of motherhood. But yeah, just like adrenaline running at all times, which definitely wasn't good for me, and you know, wouldn't have been good for Lucy either. And obviously the exhaustion, but just like panic and stress and
overwhelmed, which you can't afford to be.
Completely. Yeah. And then I had to, not only was I learning how to raise a child and all of that fun stuff, but I think it was even maybe 8 weeks in, because we had to wait certain points in time. Like she had to have her immunizations before we were allowed to spend more time on the ward with him. And then there were times where, you know, if he was actively having chemo, like make sure you're not going to sweat while you're holding her because it will come out through your pores. And, you know, like all these strange things we had to learn about.
It's unthinkable. And it's unthinkable, Brian. You know, nobody listening to this could imagine that scenario and all of those things happening. And then let's just throw in for a bit of sport, this is all happening publicly. Jared's a public figure. There are famous golfers in America sending him messages on television of get well. So that's just a nice wrinkle to have thrown in there. Now TV cameras, producers are probably ringing you or friends of yours and texting you, and we'd like to do you an interview. We want to get some pictures of Lucy, and can we come into the ward?
We did have a film crew quite early on approached about, I feel like it was Channel 7, I don't really know, but approached us about filming everything as it was happening for something. Again, I can't remember exactly what it was for, but we did a bit of filming in a park. We did some B-roll in a park with them at one stage when we were in the apartment somewhere, but then realised they wanted access to the ward, they wanted access to it, you know, and we had to then talk to someone at the hospital about it and just realize there's no way. And I'm so glad we said no, because I think even the very next day or 2 days later, we were getting results, his first lot of big results about whether the initial treatment had put him in remission, and the answer was no, and that was devastating for him. And that would have been the first thing they filmed in hospital had we allowed it. I'm so glad we didn't do it. But, yeah, he was doing, I think there was an interview with SEN that he did at that point in time, and then they actually sent us a book of all the emails that had come through as a result of his interview that people had written in. And there was one of the caddies from the US wanted to fly over and visit him and bring some stuff with him for, like, from the players. I don't even know what it was. And I actually had to say to him, you actually can't, because if you were on an international flight right now and flew over, we wouldn't want you on the ward for at least 5 or 6 days to know that you haven't carried anything with you.
Yeah.
That could, and it's not just like Jared might be okay, but he's in a shared room, a ward full of people that are, you know, immunocompromised. And we had to say, despite your best intentions and despite the fact that you are prepared to financially do that and fly over and you really want to see him, but you can't do it unless you're prepared to stay for a couple of weeks. We're going to have to say no. And there was another time that Ricky Fowler had called him, and he couldn't kind of string more than a few words together without coughing. And Ricky was on the phone, and I just remember, like, just cough, trying to have a conversation with him, and he had to pass the phone to me, and I'm like, oh, hi, Ricky. and had to just explain, I'm really sorry.
What role, if any, is golf playing in all of this, Bryony? Did it come up? Because, of course, I imagine deep down Jared's thinking at some point he wants to go back to it. Is it any sort of an incentive? You've got a newborn, you've just got married, you've got this diagnosis. Is there a role for golf in all of that, or is it on the back burner?
Yeah, early on, no. It wasn't even we couldn't escape it because of that's where communication was coming from and a lot of contact with people and messaging and whatever. But it was not even on the radar of, you know, anything. It wasn't until much further down the track where he even let the idea come into his head that, hey, this is – I want to get back to this. But – I mean, I'm sure in his mind it was there, but he just knew I think if we had started talking about it too early, it probably would have been detrimental,
yeah.
You know, to his mental health for that to be the driving factor.
Sure.
I think the timing of everything, the fact that we had Lucy to focus on, like he was, you know, he loved us being there every day despite what he was going through because he got to spend time with her. And
Did you know, I think this is probably true of all humans who go on to have children. I imagine you saw a change in him when she came along.
Yes. I also had never seen him hospitalised.
Sure.
And incredibly vulnerable because of, you know, that scenario.
So what's changed him? Is it this diagnosis or is it, and you don't know and he doesn't? Oh, God.
Yes, he did feel incredibly inadequate. I remember when we went up at the four-week mark and he hadn't seen her since the day she was born. He just didn't know how to hold her. You know, like by that stage, I'm like, you know.
Yeah, chucking her around. You know, throwing her around.
But he was, you know, like holding this thing for the first time, and that happened again and again and again. You know, like she was 6 months old before he felt that he was competent enough to, you know, be holding her properly because it would be so long in between that he wouldn't get a chance to. So I remember him feeling, that things that other people would have learnt in the first few days took months for him to get his head around. And there were, you know, things that, like when we'd take her there, even though it was incredibly inconvenient, I'd strip her off and he'd shower with her in the hospital shower just so he could have that experience and then dress her. Oh, my God, watching him try and dress her. Oh, my God. Like it just took him forever. Like it was, you know, and then he'd be exhausted because he's had a shower and he's dressed his child. Like that's the activity for the day.
I was very lucky enough once to interview Jared at an event up at Bonville. He came up and was an ambassador for something. I think they auctioned off him playing with one of the two, whatever it might have been. And we did an interview in front of the people that were gathered there. And he started to talk about how he would have tea parties with Lucy and that she would paint his fingernails. And I'm looking at this giant bear of a man and I'm thinking to myself, you can't hold a child's teacup. Look at the size of your hands.
Yeah.
This isn't working. But the way he spoke about it, you could hear just the unbridled joy in his voice that he took in that.
Yeah.
And being that and being.
And that was very much, that was probably 6, 7, 8 months in when he was discharged and out of hospital. He had all the time in the world to play tea parties all day, all day long. He didn't have, and again, that was, one of the amazing things to come out of it was that he didn't have anything to go back to. He wasn't, I've got to get back to work. He just had to focus on getting himself better, which was staying away from everybody, staying inside. And he had this 9-month-old to entertain him, and he could just give her all of his time all day, every day.
I'm exhausted thinking about it, Bryony. Were you exhausted? Were you exhausted?
Yeah. For such a long time. Yeah. It was mentally exhausting. And I had to have some really tough conversations with him because so when he was sick back when he was 17, his parents were with him all the time. His mum was with him all day, every day, and kind of just took control of everything. And okay, here's your tablet, here's your pills, here's your, now you need to do this, do that. As happens when your child is unwell, you kind of take control and help them through it. And he had the expectation that I could do that as well.
I can't help but be drawn to trying to imagine how I might have coped with all that, and I can't imagine. I can't imagine that you even know how you managed to cope with all that. In some ways, you must look back and think, wow, don't know how we did, but we did.
Yeah.
You did, of course, come through that. Jared did go into remission, went back to golf. What was that like? Was it a different thing the second time around? And, of course, just to point out how golf works, I can recall there was some early drama about him playing in the Masters here as his first tournament back with, because it was clashing with a PGA Tour event or some nonsense. In the end, we came to a resolution, if I recall. But if you want to peek into the unpleasant side of professional golf, that gave us a good idea then. So what was that like, the lead up to that? And, of course, it was a huge deal at the time. It was a big, big deal.
It was, It was, once he was back at home and – things were going in the right direction. It didn't take long for him to kind of start, what now, what now? I do remember us leaving hospital and having someone say, okay, so his immune system is compromised. He needs to avoid sand, dirt, and grass.
Okay.
Okay. And I had to actually say to them, okay, that is the most ridiculous statement right now for someone who plays golf. That's what, and we're moving to Torquay down to the beach, can we have a discussion around what exactly are the risks and how can we, avoid them or
mitigate,
come up with other? Yeah. That's just so ridiculous, the stuff that they would kind of send people. Terrifying.
Yeah.
Can I not walk on grass? Can I, and to have a child, who's going to scratch around and, eat the stuff. He it didn't take long for him to kind of say, what if, is this something we could do? And I, seeing as he was home, I managed to pick up a job, a local job, just working a few days in a local business because one of us needed to work and have a bit of an income. But as soon as he raised that question of, okay, what if, I knew that meant
we're starting. We start today.
Yeah. And I have to quit my job because that means you then spend ridiculous amounts of time on the range. It starts all over again. So we, had to have some pretty serious discussions around it and he had to kind of work himself up to it. And it was, okay, go for a walk. and let's see how far you can walk first before I kind of quit my job and you think you're going to get back out there. And go to the range and see how long you can hit balls for before, and how many days is it going to take you to recover from an hour on the range before we get too carried away. So very slow process. So we were able to start incorporating those little things while I was still working. But then it gets to the point where no amount of practice on the range and no amount of one round at a time can prepare you for what a 4-day professional event looks like. So we had to try and replicate that, which you can't do.
Of course you can't.
But you had to try and get him playing consecutive days and trying to compete for consecutive days. So we set up all these crazy little ideas with the guys at the Sands and, trying to have all the members play against him and you know, have this running tally, you know, I don't even really understand how we did it, but, you know, just getting people out there to play with him and which they, you know, they loved it. People got on board with it, you know, some of them would offer to caddy for him.
People paid for that, Bryony. People pay to go and watch a guy like Jared play golf. It's a thing.
But we needed it. We actually felt we were, you know, asking too much of them to say, you know, can you get out here and play your best golf? and you know, just get him out there playing. So it was great. He really enjoyed that. But again, the next step from that is to actually, I think he then did a few pro-ams, but there weren't any 4-day ones around. And even that level isn't high enough to try and replicate the added mental stress and all the rest of it. We then had to kind of earmark an event to see how he would go with it. Never thinking, and again, I think the issue with it was, so he's given 20 starts on his medical. So we had to, then it becomes the picking and choosing, but those starts, to be beneficial, they had to be 20 starts, and that was PGA Tour because that's what he'd come off playing.
That's right.
Those 20 starts on the combined nationwide PGA. So, and it has to be at that level. Like if you played 5 of them as, you know, like the Murray River Classic or, you know, whatever, it's, you're doing yourself a disservice because
you're wasting potential.
You're wasting it. So any event that had world golf ranking points counted. So, you know, like your Vic Opens and things like that, to the best of my knowledge, you know, like they have points associated with them, but you're almost wasting a start.
Yeah.
By doing that one, because the prize money then wouldn't count to where it needed to count, you know, like all of it. But that's one event gone, and it was, so as little or as much as I had learned about golf to that point, this was a whole nother level of trying to navigate. What does this medical mean? How do we, like, how do we? Because not only was it getting himself ready to play again, we then had to relocate back to the US. And do it in the US without the support and the medical personnel and the everyone around us. So he, you know, he had to be at a certain stage and with a child So yeah, the issue with, we had to choose an Aussie event. It had world golf ranking points, but the prize money was not going to count towards the money that he needed to earn to get his card back and all the rest of it. And then after the event, we hadn't intended for it to be one of his 20 events, because you were allowed to have a certain number of warm-up events, and this was going to be a warm-up event for him. But afterwards, the powers that be made the decision that, no, that was one of his starts. Even though if anyone saw him on Sunday afternoon, it was very clear he was a long way away from being competitive, you know, any golf tour.
Yeah. If all our golf talk has you itching for a round, then make sure you check out Golf Now. The Golf Now app and website gives you an easy way to book social golf online at hundreds of courses across Australia, including some of Golf Australia's top 100 tracks. No queues, no call waiting, just the tee times you want at your fingertips 24/7. Download the free app or visit golfnow.com.au today. Go play. Within all of that and through all of that, that's the administrative side of the game. You can understand they've got to have rules and those things, and I'd imagine it's difficult to navigate from the other side as too. But what about the golf family broadly? I remember speaking to Mike Clayton about this after Jared had passed, and there was – I'm not sure. I know that PGA Tour players have pension plans and those kinds of things. We were talking about what that might mean for yourself and two young kids. I mean, that's a – wow, that's a hell of a thing to happen. And I remember Clayton saying, I remember thinking at the time, what a beautiful – in a game so awash with money, you would hope that wouldn't be an issue for Bryony. Has the golf family – and I don't mean necessarily just financially, but has the golf family embraced you, do you feel? Has the fraternity – there was a lot – look, it's very public, Bryony. And you're dealing with people who like cameras, let's not pretend otherwise, and there's a lot to be gained sometimes. Has that been the case? Do you feel that the Golf family's been – has embraced you since Jared passed?
I'm pausing for a very long time on this question because he and I spoke about it, and I've obviously had my own feelings about it subsequently. I mean, there were a lot of people said a lot of things because it was good for their brand and their image. Mm. But were any of those words translating into any kind of practical support?
It's the question I was trying to ask.
9 times out of 10, no. With the exception of Robert Allenby.
Yeah.
So he, like, yes, he did his, like, the public stuff around it. He, you know, like, I know that, you know, he was called upon to say certain things. Great. But what people didn't know was behind the scenes was daily messages, daily phone calls, daily check-ins, you know, to me, to Jared, to, you know, he honestly wanted to know that things were okay or moving in the right direction. Whereas other players got their minutes of fame out of it, knowing that it was the topical story of the time and that they needed to, you know, be seen to be part of it, but then they disappeared. And we both vividly remember the experience of going back to the US when he did finally get back there, and the difference between the PGA Tour and the Nationwide Tour, and it wouldn't have been Nationwide at that point in time, but night and day, the reception he received on the Nationwide Tour was phenomenal and genuine. People that weren't there when he'd left were coming up and making a point, and not in front of the cameras, mm-hmm. not on social media, but person to person, introducing themselves, saying something really nice, wishing him well, celebrating his performance, stopping him afterwards. You know, it was amazing. And not, like, not necessarily for me, because they didn't know who I was, and that was perfectly fine. They don't need to come over and introduce themselves to me. But he really knows that. He really felt welcomed and, you know, embraced and supported and whatever by people that weren't there when he had left, which was quite amazing. But the PGA Tour, the first event he played there, I think it was Charlotte. So Quail Hollow?
Quail Hollow, yeah.
Maybe?
Yep.
So I think Tiger was playing that event, which changes everything. At that point in time, if Tiger was at an event, the security's upped, you know, everyone's hyper alert. It's a ridiculous level of places where you could have easily gone with your credentials, you know. And I'm pretty sure that was that week he was there. And we kind of walked into the players' dining area, and these were the guys that he'd left, and a lot of them were in similar age to him, similar stage of life in that they were kind of just starting out with families, married, you know, like there was a whole group of them that were quite, you know, on very similar stages of life. And we had left pregnant, planning to get married, you know, oh, next time we see you, we're going to have a baby, and, you know, how exciting and all the rest of it. And we both walked in and sat on our own in the dining room. A couple of guys, hey, mate, as they walked past, you know, good to see you, buddy, kind of thing. It was nothing. And I had one of the wives who I thought I was actually quite close to before we left, and knowing we were planning to move to the US and that would be our life, you know, I was really had been making an effort before we headed away. And I'd never forget, like, stopping at the seeing me, stopping next to the table and saying, hey, friend, good to see you again. And just walking off and sitting with the others and not another word about, like, what? This is, I left heavily pregnant, getting married. He then relapsed. You're like, we've been gone for years.
Mm.
And this massive thing has happened in our life, and nobody gave a shit because He hadn't won on the PGA Tour.
A couple of things. First things first. Robert Allenby has always been a somewhat contentious character.
Yeah.
He's got plenty of critics and he's deserved a lot of the criticism. I've given some of it myself. He rarely gets the credit, I think, for what he genuinely does behind the scenes and has done, yeah. Not just for Jared, but for and for the game for the game here in Australia. I remember talking to him when he's 20th consecutive Australian Open. Name another Australian PGA Tour player who played 20th consecutive Australian Open. So he gets credit for that. Do you think, Bryony, that that response you're describing, I feel like in part that's a response to illness as well. I think we've probably all been guilty of it when somebody you've had a passing connection with in life gets sick, really sick, cancer or something like that. It's difficult to know how to respond when you see them again. I wonder, do you think what part of it was that and what part is just that surreal world that is the PGA Tour where you're all friends, but really when push comes to shove, I'd put a knife in you before you put a knife in me because that's what we're here to do.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of those players that I was talking about as being in a similar stage of life had all had their wins.
Yeah.
So they'd all kind of gone to that next level on the tour where they were known, they were a name, they were in contention, they were potentially, you know, performing or top 10 or, you know, they were getting some coverage, they had gotten new deals, they were getting sponsorship, you know, all the rest of it just had changed.
They'd moved up in the caste system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so Jared, again, he said at the end of that week, he'd said to me that, you know, like people I've never met before are the ones that have stopped me in the locker room or on the range or gone out of their way. He goes, but these guys who I thought I knew and I, you know, he knew that they weren't mates, you know, as Aussie mates, but like people that were really close to you and, you know, you're experiencing the same things together day in, day out and kind of on this journey together. He said, these guys who, like, were in front of the camera when it all came out at the start, you know, we're here to support you, anything you need. And then he said they didn't even stop what they were doing long enough to acknowledge his presence. And that was, like, bang, you know, week one was, okay, we're back at this. This is nothing but a grind. And it almost became, because he wasn't performing. He wasn't even close. He was, you know, I think he missed 20 cuts of his, you know, or 19 cuts of his 20 starts or whatever. So he, and again, if you are performing on the tour, then, you know, you've got lots of friends.
Yeah.
But he wasn't performing. So it's almost like people are almost happy to see his name on the list because it's like, oh, that's one less person I have to compete against this week. So that was a super, super tough time. Like, you know, walking back into that environment that he knew I didn't enjoy with a child and to feel so not welcome as well was really tough.
Just on a side note, interesting to hear you there describe, you know, those players, they'd had their win. They're almost like children, aren't they? This is where he's had his win. It's changed. That's been the whole goal. We've had a win. It's a hell of a thing to devote your life to, isn't it?
It is. At that level, it's like it was $1 million first prize. So they've had their win, which means they've bought a new house.
Yeah.
They've relocated. They've, you know, like it was a process that we saw them all go through.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're on the same path yourself. That's what you're trying to do. Everyone's trying to do the same thing to get to the same place. A couple of things I've got to ask you about. I've just noted how long we've been talking. My goodness, it's fascinating stuff. Talk to me about the hole-in-one in Arizona. Might be one of the most famous moments in all of golf and recreated magnificently at Jared's memorial service, I thought. What a special moment that was. But there's two holes in one at that hole that stand out. One was Tiger and the other one is Jared, I think.
Have you compared the footage, though, like of Tiger's one to what happened like this year or whatever?
Yeah. Let's put that aside for the moment and what's happening to the game at the top level and how Jared might have felt about that, or we can come to that later perhaps. But just what do you remember about that time, that day?
I wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I was at home. That was early was like February or something in 2011.
Yep.
I was back in Australia. I was finishing my massage course. That's what I was doing. I was finishing the last couple of units of my massage course. Or no, not quite, because it was the following year. I was doing a couple of units over the summer anyway, and that we had some kind of on-site practical stuff. And still living in the – at that time I was staying with my dad in the caravan park.
Lovely.
And I remember driving into the city to go to this course that I was doing, and Jared called me. It was like 8:30, something quite early. He said, oh, I just need to let you know I've had a hole in one. Oh, okay. Like, I'm sitting in the car park ready to go there. Okay, that's great. And he said, oh, I'm about to be interviewed on the radio, and it would have been – is Eddie – does Eddie McGuire, does he do SEN?
I don't know. What do I know about radio?
Yeah. No, he doesn't. Anyway, it was him and the footy boys were interviewing Jared about this hole in one. He said, oh, so if you're in the car, like, switch it to the okay. Like, I've only got a few minutes, but I'll do that.
I've got things to do here, love, but all right, if you insist.
Yeah. So, like, I did. I switched and I listened to him talking because I hadn't seen it. I had no idea what he was talking about, and listened to them. And, again, I was like, oh, yeah, sounds cool, you know, well done. And then kind of switched it right off and had to race inside. And but then during lunch at this massage course, someone happened to say, hey, has anyone seen the news? Some guy got a hole in what? And I just kind of had a little kind of laugh to myself about it. I didn't say anything because I didn't know these people. I didn't say anything. And then later that night at home, just put on the news, and there was the footage of. I was like, that's what we were talking about. Wow. That's what happened. And at that point, okay. And I think I rang him. I'm like,
sorry.
Okay, now
yes. Sorry.
Now I kind of know what you're talking about. So that was it. And then the next day, the massage, and someone had said, hey, did you watch the news last night and see that footage? Like, how funny was that of the guy? And I eventually did say,
that's right. Oh, I know him. He used to be quite famous in Shepparton years ago. He was in the paper occasionally.
That was like, it was similar to when he won on the Nationwide Tour. Must have been 2008. We were dating. I was fruit picking. I'm in the orchard. He rang. It wasn't break time, and he rang me, and I happened to answer my phone quickly. He goes, I'm just letting you know I've just won. Okay, great. I'm not on my break. I have to get back to
it. It wasn't break time.
Like, I could see my supervisor driving down the road. I've got to go. Well done.
Yes.
Because this was still very early between the two of us, and I'm thinking, isn't that the whole point?
That's right. Is that exciting? Like, do you not do that all the time? Isn't that the
supposed to win? Well done. And my supervisor was driving towards me, and he happened to say something, and he said, how's Jared going? I said, he just rang quickly. Like, I'm sorry, I took the call, but he just rang quickly to say that he'd won. It's like, and he, what? Like, where's he playing? I don't know. Like, somewhere in the US. Like, he won something. I'm getting back to it. And then, like, you know, later in the day, I think he had to drive back to me and go, okay,
this is what he won.
He won. And I'm like, okay, great. He goes, you know, this prize money, isn't this what he does?
Yes, that's right.
Like, and I said, okay, so what sort of prize money? Like, $20,000? Like, and he's like, it would have been $85,000. What? So again, it wasn't until later that night that I could process it and speak to him again and go, okay, okay, that sounds amazing. And apparently this doesn't happen.
No, for a lot of people doesn't. Did you get one of those giant checks? Have you ever one of those big novelty checks? I've always wanted one of those.
There were some in the garage in the US.
God, that'd be fantastic.
But I remembered, I think it was that one. Like, again, the local paper, the next day or something, front page was a photo of him with the amount of money that he'd won.
Yeah.
And I then had really inappropriate messages from people during the day with this assumption that I had somehow
– you're rich now.
This was going to be my money or something. And I remember I happened to know the editor of the paper at that time. And I sent him a message and said, I actually don't think you should have you shouldn't have been allowed to do that. Like, I know it's public knowledge, but the way you went about that was not, I didn't think that was appropriate, actually, for that to be the lead story.
It's the point of the whole thing, though, isn't it, Bryony? Professional golf.
Unfortunately, it is. Yeah, yeah. The whole point. It is. It's you need the money to move up the rankings and to, you know, further yourself. Like, it is. It's driven by money. Yeah.
Indeed. Of course, Bryony, we know how this story ends, and it's not a happy ending. And an awful time, no doubt, for you and for Jared. But out of all of what's happened, you were heavily involved with Challenge, until just recently, in fact, I think, heavily involved. What's that been like, and what have you sort of learned along the way there? And what's the sort of the future? We've said it already, golf's awash with money. It's a fabulous vehicle for raising money. Have you found that? And in some way, has Jared's passing been a positive in terms of ensuring finances continue to roll into that charity challenge?
Yes. Yeah, it was, again, so bizarre that I ended up even more in the world of golf. And it was as a direct result of the support that was shown for Jared. From the point pretty much where he chose palliative care, you know, onwards, it just kind of went through the, like, people just mobilized like I've never seen before. And I probably only know about 10% of it, really, of what kind of was going on out there. And was obviously a whole lot of other stuff going on for me and wasn't paying any attention. But very soon after he had died, I became aware of what was happening at Challenge in terms of the people raising money and having golf days, and then the amount of the merchandise that was being purchased globally, that people had kind of grabbed onto this symbol, this kind of Luke the Duck symbol, as being something that attached them to Jared as well. And the sales of products went through the roof. And up until that point in time, I think it's fair to say, had just kind of been a nice little thing that would tick along in the side every now and then, and Jared would use and carry these products and Rob would use and carry these products, but it really hadn't done a great deal outside of little events that Challenge would do. And then suddenly it, you know, kind of went global. And it wasn't, maybe only a couple of months after he died, I think I kind of started heading into the office at Challenge and saying, hey, I feel like we've kind of created this, so I'm here to help. I want something to do. And he and I had been had a business that we'd been working on that was selling products into the golf industry. So I had knowledge of merchandising and sales and wanted to do something. So I kind of offered my time and started out as a volunteer for a while, but it just grew and grew and grew. And I said, you know, I'd love to step in here and work for Challenge and kind of take over this merchandise beast, and try and get it a bit organized and make it not such a kind of a burden on the organization. And so that's what happened. And then we also, in discussions with Gavin Kirkman from the PGA of Australia, tried to figure out a way that we could, all of that kind of spontaneous support that happened around Australia at golf clubs and whatever, how could we kind of bring all that together in an organized way and see if we could actually really create something quite tangible and quite solid in memory of Jared. And so we worked together to create the campaign called Doing It for Jared that we've then kind of rolled out these last few years to golf clubs around the country. And it's been, I think it's been an incredibly positive part of my journey to be involved in that and to feel as though I'm doing something with my grief, but also with Jared's life, to keep, you know, that it's not in vain and that we can use what he'd started, I guess, in such a positive way for Challenge. But I was there, I must have started, so he died in 2018. I think maybe kind of January of 2019, I was working at Challenge.
Luke the Duck is an extraordinary marketing tool, Bryony, is it not?
Yes. Yeah. It's actually just been, it's to this day, it just blows my mind actually how that brand was embraced and whatever by the Australian golf industry primarily. Like we do, there are a lot of fans and supporters kind of in other parts of the world. But I think it just became a really tangible thing that people could do because so many people felt something with Jared's death, and this gave them a really positive way to know that they were getting a product, but that they were doing something that was going to help, you know, the challenged families that he was so passionate about. So, and he always used to think, he always felt guilty that because of what he did for a living, it gave him the platform to be able to do something, but he never felt he had enough time to do as much as he wanted to do. But, and so I'd kind of joke with him about, you've gone to extremes, haven't you, to, you know, try and help challenge.
That's right. We'll talk very briefly in a moment about humour and the importance of its role, but I suspect particularly for somebody like Jared. The thing about Luke, I think, that works, we see this with Glenn McGrath and the pink out day at the test. We see the yellow thing at the PGA. There's a direct link between Luke, the product, and Jared. Luke the Duck existed before Jared came along.
100%.
But everybody who buys a Luke the Duck product, there's an immediate link there of Jared. That's who you think of. You think of Jared.
And
what an ongoing and extraordinary legacy that is. If we could talk to him, Bryony, between golf and he's had these two crazy kind of careers in a way, which do you think would be most important to Jared? What he's done in golf, what he's done for challenge?
100% what he's done for challenge. Yeah, and it's not just, you know, like it's one thing to have a platform and be approached by an organization to say, hey, would you possibly, you know, but he was the recipient of Challenge products and services back when he was 17. So he knew firsthand and also having the kind of the state of mind also to be a 17-year-old and they put him in the children's hospital at the time, which it could have gone either way. Like he could have been treated as an adult or he could have been as a child, but for some reason they chose, let's put him in the children's hospital, which means he was surrounded by very young kids and in shared rooms. And he would, you know, even as an adult, he would get upset at the thought of these kids who were there one day and he'd wake up the next and they were gone. And him knowing as a 17-year-old what had happened to them, but knowing that they didn't know, you know, they weren't expecting it. They were just kids, you know, some of them were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. So he had, you know, first-hand experience of what it was all about and what, you know, what those kids might have needed or could have benefited from or, you know, wouldn't have changed the outcome of their life and their treatment plan and all the rest of it. But just, he would speak about this one girl in particular that he would play like peekaboo with her around the curtain in his room, and she didn't speak English very well. Just like the fear that she had, and he's like, the one thing I can do is like make her laugh for 5 minutes while I, you know, hide myself behind this curtain, and then she was gone the next day, you know. And so it wasn't just kind of challenge saying, hey, would you mind, you know, lending your face to and helping us out? It was him, you know, I want to do this. I need to do this. I now have a platform and I want people to know that this organization, you know, changes people's lives at the worst time.
Yeah. And, of course, Bryony, you've got your own children, you and Jared. What an incredibly difficult time. I've read a few of the stories and seen some of the quotes and you've been interviewed on television. We can see the tears and the reality of it and you know, having your daughter ask, you know, when daddy's finished dying, will he be coming home? You can't read that and not shed a tear either. 5 years on, I feel as though you've been heavily involved in palliative care organisations and learning something because, of course, you nursed Jared in his final times, which is incredibly brave, and I can't imagine how you did that. How about all of that? A death always affects. It's like dropping a stone in a pond, isn't it? The circles go out. Someone who's got young children and dies, that's an extraordinarily, intensely more powerful thing. How's all that from 5 years down the track? Sort of what have you learnt? How have the girls, I think you've got two girls, Lucy and Gemma.
Yeah.
How's that? How do you deal with that? What do you say to kids? There's no textbook for that either, is there? You know, nobody tells you here's the cheat sheet for how to deal with dad dying when you're 7 years old.
Yeah. I mean, how long have we got?
That's a perfectly reasonable answer, absolutely. I don't even know what I'm asking, I suppose, but I wonder how you're going as part of it. How are you doing?
No, well, I mean, a lot of changes within the last 12 months, actually. So it's in, like, you know, the timing of talking to you and whatever is really interesting. Because coming to that realization a few months ago that the being at Challenge was no longer feeling like a really positive thing. It felt like it was kind of, as much as I was like, people think you move on and you don't move on. Like, you don't get over things. You don't get over the death of your partner and whatever, but you just get on with things because you have no choice, especially when you got kids. So I'm really starting to try and, okay, what does it look like going forward now? There's a future out there. What is that going to look like? And I realized that the work kept taking me back. And it was emotionally exhausting. I really had to kind of stop myself and say, you know, what am I going to miss if I step away from this? Like I'd felt up until that point in time that if it wasn't me driving it, no one would drive it. And, you know, we wouldn't get anywhere with it. But I just realized I think it has taken on a bit of a life of its own in terms of, you know, his legacy. And it will, just by nature of, it's like with natural disasters or anything that happened, you know, the support is there and then it just, the next one comes along and it all dies down again. And so we're anticipating that things will, as time passes, and, you know, a new generation comes through who don't know Jared, then, you know, it's harder to sell the idea of raising money and whatever in his name, and we know that. We're not there yet. It still continues to grow, and which is phenomenal. And I don't know why or how or whatever, but you know, each year we kind of have been stepping it up and stepping it up. So I needed to get out of it in order to separate myself and look towards the future and not, you know, have work that kind of kept reminding me of what had happened.
Is there a role for that for a while and then it comes time to move on? I would imagine that's talk about powerful, going to work every day at the organisation that has been such a part of your husband's life for all that time and the father of your children, and then he's passed and you're doing this. I could see the appeal of that for a time, but there must come a time, it feels like, and perhaps this was that time.
Yeah, it is kind of just quite evolve quite naturally, I think. And it had been, as I said, like it was such a positive part of it, like to feel like I'm doing something. I'm, you know, like I'm employed because of what happened to him and I'm involved in this really exciting time. And you know, it's so personal to me and I'm so passionate about it. So I was so driven to, you know, make the most out of it. And really, I'm sure I've annoyed a lot of the people in my determination to, you know, make it work. But, yeah, it was – the time had come. And I'd done a few events, so the PGA Champs last year, because in amongst being there selling product and working in the tent all day, and it's long days and it's, you know, we're so busy and we're trying to turn everything yellow and it's amazing. But in amongst that, I get interviewed or I get asked to host something or whatever, and people want to see you upset. And on any given day, I mean, if we did this interview tomorrow, I could be in a completely different state of mind, and what I would say and the way I'd react to it would be completely different. But so they kind of like, there is a bit of push, push, push to try and get the emotion to the surface. And I'm like, I'm so exhausted. I've been working in the tent, you know, for 3 days, massive days, and seeing the players that I only get to see once a year, and the caddies and the staff around them and all the rest of it, massive week. And I kind of step from behind the microphone and behind the camera back into the tent selling products, and I'm a mess, and there was no separation in between the two. So
it's a machine, isn't it? You've created a machine, and at some point you become one of the cogs in the gearbox.
Yes.
And it's not what you started it as. It's turned into something else.
Yeah, entirely. It has. And then the TPS event, the Murray River event in honour of Jared too, is something that's kind of really personal to me. And the same up there again, you know, and it's also positive and it's growing and it's all these opportunities and people, you know, wanting to do these amazing things. And so I'm speaking up there and then serving customers, and then I'm speaking to a room, and then I'm so, and I just, I'm so drained, just exhausted, and then coming home, you know, from a week like that, and back to the girls, and Mum, you're always away.
Yeah, that's right. Where's my breakfast? Where's my lunch? Where's my colouring in?
So I think I'm still involved. I'm not going anywhere, and I'm still very much, you know, involved in what happens with Jared's legacy and all the rest of it. And I will still be involved in the PGA event later this year, and in the TPS in particular, because they're two that are really important to me. But just in a different way. You know, if I'm there to host an event, and then maybe I don't have to step back into the tent and sell products, you know, I can take on a bit of a different role. And
I'm very interested in this notion of feeling a pressure to have some sort of performative element, something about that being in the public eye, and something about that. We're very demanding as a public, aren't we? And we set very clear rules about what it is that we want you to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And what does a widow look like?
Yeah.
And, you know, how long is the expectation that I'm, you know, upset, and I've actually embraced, like, grief is fascinating. And I think it's, you know, it's the one thing that humans share. Mm-hmm. And yet in our culture, we don't talk about it.
No, God, no.
We don't know what to say. It's all uncomfortable. Let's not talk about death. Let's pretend it's not happening. Let's, you know, and then have expectations of how people deal with it and how they move on from it and get over it and all the rest of it. And I've actually really embraced, learned a lot from it, obviously, and it's horrible, but I'm also raising kids and I want them to be okay. So I've actually, like, dived into trying to learn more about grief and look for resources and look for different things. And I've found some organisations that have set up specifically for widowed people, because it's just such a unique experience and just cannot really be understood. And we all get together and share our stories about people saying, I know exactly how you feel. My husband's a fly-in, fly-out worker. Okay.
So correlation there.
Dual income. That's a dual income, isn't it? And that's a husband who does come home, and children that have still got both parents. Yeah, I can see how that's quite similar. Yeah.
There's no malice in that, though, is there, Bryony?
No, there's not. You've got to be aware that, you know, people are, on the most part, mean well, and they don't know what to say. We don't know what to say. And prior to this happening to me, I probably said really inappropriate things to people, thinking I was being helpful or whatever. But when you're in a room full of widows, you hear some stories about what people have said, and or advice that's been offered, or, you know, whatever. But it's pretty empowering.
Whilst I'm thoroughly enjoying chatting to you, I must let you go at some point, but I must ask you about this. You chose to nurse Jared in his last days alongside his auntie, who's a palliative care nurse, and you've since been involved in the palliative care space at various conferences and things. I know that. Why? Why did you do that? Was that a difficult decision to take? My instinct is I'd run a mile from that, but you didn't.
Well, I mean, I really don't know if I can claim to have nursed him, to be honest. At that point in time, I mean, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in it, you know, I helped organise it. got everything organised, all the practical stuff, you know, got the house set up and got what we needed and, you know.
Which, Anna, by the way, I never considered, and I imagine nobody ever considered, that's a whole full-time job in itself just there, is it? Now, finding out what you've got to do. Yeah. Then B, finding all the bits and pieces and the supplies and getting it delivered.
And it's all, like, it's so time sensitive too. Like, if we had taken too long to get the bed that we needed, you know, then he wouldn't have been able to come home, you know, and he could have ended up dying in hospital, you know, which is what he didn't want. So there are times when, so the last couple of days in the hospital on the ward, you know, that those were times when, so Mark Hayes was in with Jared interviewing him with his final words and all the rest of it, and like some quotes and some articles that went out that were really quite profound and whatever at that time. I was not in the room because I was outside talking with the palliative care team about, okay, what do we need? What is the equipment we need? Where do I get it from? Where do I? So I wasn't there for any of that. Probably, thank goodness, in the end, because to this day, you know, like Hazy will never forget those times in the room with him and whatever. But, I was absent. And even for quite a few of the days when he was back at home, I was doing stuff. I was with funeral directors and I was, you know, choosing coffins and I was doing various things, then going back and talking to Jared about it. You know, the coffin you wanted is not available. We need to choose something else.
I can't fathom those conversations, you know. You just can't imagine sort of what's that like. Jared was a guy who laughed a joke almost more than anything, I would think. What role has humour played, did humour play in all that, and what role does it continue to play in what is going to be an ongoing grieving process for the rest of your life, obviously?
Yeah. It plays such a massive part of it. And knowing that that's who Jared was as well, I think makes it so much easier. Like knowing that he would laugh along with this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the black humour and everything that comes out in these weird groups and what, you know, like he would find it as funny as the next person, I think. And even, you know, like I have memories of the funny things that happened literally, you know, in the last few days of his life, some of the things that he would say. We had his really close schoolmates. There was five of them that came down and spent the weekend with him. So it would have been, 5 days, I guess, before he died, and they were cooking bacon and sausages and whatever on the barbecue just on the balcony outside so that he could smell it. Like, we knew he wasn't going to eat it, but to be able to smell it, and they were all drinking and just reminiscing and just talking shit like they do. And we'd said to him, like, why don't you have a beer? Like, have a sip. Why not? You've got the smell of the sausages and the bacon and, you know, just have a sip of beer. No, I don't want – like, go on. Like, what are you – I think he was still drinking Diet Coke at that stage.
He would have too.
And we were like, go on. How much? No, I'm not. And he turned around and said to me, because I was like, what's the worst that could happen? I could die. And that's what he said. I could die. Okay.
Bryony, what a note to leave it on. I think that's quintessential Jared for anybody who might have met him. It's been fabulous of you to take so much time today and to be so open and vulnerable in such a huge deal in anybody's life. It's been fabulous to chat to you. And thank you. And thank you for all the work you've done with Challenge and what is going to be an ongoing, I'm sure, within golf campaign forever. So thank you.
Thanks, Rod. It hasn't felt like all that much time. And it's always, you kind of thank me as if I've done something, but like all of these experiences are helpful to me as well. Like I enjoy reminiscing on things and talking about various things. So thank you for the opportunity.
I'll send you an invoice in that case. As it's
okay, great.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
No worries.
If you look up strength in the face of adversity in the dictionary, I reckon you might just find a picture of Bryony Lyle. Jared's left a lasting legacy on the game, no doubt. But in her own way, so too has Bryony. Well, that's it for episode 100 of the pod, but I hope you've followed on your preferred podcast app because the next few weeks are going to be a feast of John Huggan. Huggy's done a series of interviews with players, not specifically about the Ryder Cup, but with plenty of talk about that fabulous competition, which gets underway in just about a month. This is going to be a fantastic lead-up. First up is Graeme McDowell, and it's an interview that, trust me, you don't want to miss.
No, I mean, like I say, the team experience that I've had in my career far outshine any individual experiences I've ever had. You know, I mean, the Ryder Cup is something super special.
Hang on a minute. We're talking about somebody here who won the US Open at Pebble Beach. Are you telling me that that's below what you just talked about?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I think emotionally, emotionally there's nothing quite like team events.
That's next time on The Thing About Golf.